100 years ago today, on the top of Denali, nothing happened. No human being had ever made it to the top of North America's tallest peak, but they were soon to be on their way. Stuck, Harper, and Karstens on the historic expedition that conquered Denali in 1913. Now in 2013, the descendants of those climbers are going back to do it again. It's Alaska's greatest climb, today on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
Providence Imaging Center, with Drs. Scott Nespinski and Christopher Reed, providing interpretations of imaging studies with a focus on musculoskeletal radiology, provimaging.com. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you are an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an individual artist award. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
I'm Charles Wolforth. I'm sitting in for Steve Heimel today on Talk of Alaska, and I'm lucky because our topic is a fascinating one. Denali, the first successful climb of Denali. Also, we're going to talk about a previous unsuccessful climb that happened in 1912. And we've got the descendants of some of those early climbers who are going to try to climb the mountain again this coming summer. So we're going to have four guests on the air at various times today, and we've got a lot to talk about, so it'll be a fun show. If you want to get on with our guests, the number here in Anchorage is 550-8422, outside of Anchorage, 1-800-478-8255, and we would love to hear from you. In the studio with me this morning is Brian Ochnick, who has been up the mountain some 30 times, and as a mountaineering guide, and has been researching the Belmore Brown attempt at Denali, which made it within a few hundred feet vertically of the summit in 1912 and had to turn back. Thanks for being with us, Brian.
Thanks. It's nice to be here, Charles.
And on the phone, we have Ken Karstens, who's the great-grandson of Harry Karstens, a legendary Alaskan who was on that original climb that made it to the top in 1913 and then became the first superintendent of Denali National Park. Ken, thanks for being with us.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
And finally, on the phone from Ottawa is Ilya Sekaly, who is the with a Finding Life filmmaking a production company, and who's organizing the Centennial Climb with the original climbers. And thanks very much for being with us, Ilya.
Pleasure to be here, thanks.
And so the first climb that made it to the top, we call it the Hudson Stuck Climb. Hudson Stuck was the Archdeacon of the Arctic for the Episcopal Church and went all over Alaska on a dog sled, but had never climbed a major mountain. Walter Harper, who was Stuck's assistant, Harry Karstens, who was a legendary outdoorsman, and Robert Tatum, who was, I guess, the cook on the expedition and is not actually represented, I don't think, in your repeat expedition. Ilya, tell me how this came about, that you're going to repeat this climb. What was the inspiration of it, and what are you hoping to accomplish?
Well, I think first and foremost, to take a very long story and make it incredibly short, serendipity brought Hudson Stuck's great-great-nephew together, who happens to live in Ottawa. So he and I became very good friends, and his name is Dan Hopkins. So Dan was climbing Denali in 2008, trying to learn about his great-great-uncle's life's work. So he was on his way to the summit of Denali. Our paths intersected, and we came up with this idea to create this centennial climb to honor the legacy of his great-great-uncle. Little did we know that the Karstens families were out there and that the Harper families were out there. And so I would say after 5 years of work, we teamed up with, you know, partners from Alaska, you know, Ken and cousin Ray and his family. And together we put this centennial climb and project together. And I think there are multiple agendas. I think at the forefront, it's to recognize the tremendous efforts of all of these families, all of these men, and then also to inspire young Alaskan Native youth through the telling of, you know, this great legendary untold story.
Well, and it's I think it's untold in a lot of places, but I think a good number of Alaskans know the names at least, and know that these were the ones who finally made it. And so I think there's a good deal of excitement in seeing you guys come back and give it another shot. I mean, have you gotten a good reaction from Alaskans since you announced this?
It's been a tremendous amount of work with a tremendous amount of challenge. And, you know, just in your introduction there, I think it's most important to note as well that there were the four men that reached the summit, but there were also two other young Native Alaskans, John Fredson and Esaias George, who were incredible contributors to the climb and to the success of the climb. In terms of feedback, I mean, absolutely, we announced this last Tuesday. All the families flew into Alaska, came together, announced this at St. Matthew's Parish, which is the launch point back in 1913. Feedback has been great, but it's been a really huge challenge to raise the money to make this happen and to gain the support that we need on behalf of every team member to make this come to life. So really, I think we are where we are because we all believe in this incredibly, and you know, the families of all of the historical First Ascent members have been pushing extremely hard since day one to make this happen. So it hasn't been as easy as we would have hoped, but we are receiving tremendous feedback, yes.
Well, I guess it wasn't easy for those guys either. So, yeah, it's really a tremendous thing you're attempting to do. We'll see. You know, obviously, a lot of challenges still ahead of you. I wanted to turn to Brian Ochnick in the studio. When these guys did their climb, they walked from Nenana to the mountain, as I understand it, and then climbed up the top, and they didn't know the best route. How did their achievement compare to what we do today when we climb the mountain? I mean, obviously many people climb it now, but does anybody walk from Nenana to the mountain before they start?
No, that's very unusual now. Of course, now we have airplanes, and so most people choose to fly in. At that time, the normal means of travel in the winter was by dog sled, and it was an incredible network of trails and roadhouses in the country. And Stuck had spent, you know, most of the winter with Harper going from mission to mission. They'd actually left Tanana on January 22nd and gone all the way down, had left Fort Yukon and gone down to Tanana and then up the Tanana River to Fairbanks and then continued upriver from there going to the missions, went up to Mansfield Lake and then returned to Fairbanks and didn't get on the trails to Denali till the middle of March. So they were very trail-wise, incredible winter outdoorsmen, very, very comfortable in what Stuck would call strong cold. Whenever it got below 50 below, it was a strong cold. And they followed a route to the base of the mountain that had been used by the prospectors and the miners in the Kantishna district, over to the Toklat River and up the Toklat and over into the headwaters of Moose Creek. And there were some roadhouses and some tent camps and some hunters along the way where they actually stayed. And so actually getting to the mountain was known at that time, how to get there mm-hmm. from Fairbanks. The Sourdoughs in 1910 had pioneered the route to the base of the mountain and then on up the Muldrow Glacier and Carson's Ridge, as it later became called, the Northeast Ridge on Denali. What was, unknown territory to them was the glacier travel and the mountaineering challenge.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
they learned by the School of Hard Knocks.
Had nobody to tell them how to do it.
That's right. That's right.
And you've done a good deal of study on the unsuccessful climbs before, particularly the Belmore Brown climb. What turned them back? Was it weather? Was it altitude?
It was weather. They had established a high camp at 16,000.
So this would have been the 1912 attempt.
1912. Yeah, there were three of them, Belmore Brown, Merle Lavoie, and Herschel Parker. It established a high camp at 16,600 feet on the Harper Glacier, which is a high glacier between the north and the south summits of Denali. And twice they tried to get to the summit, each time being beaten back by weather that moved in, bringing extremely high winds and zero visibility and blowing snow. and they pushed it as far as they could, and got to the point where they just physically could not move against the wind, and got beat back, and then descended the mountain. And fortunately, they did descend the mountain because there was later a devastating earthquake that would have, very likely have killed them on the mountain, or at least made their descent impossible.
Just it makes you realize the hazards and difficulty that these. I mean, it's not easy now, obviously, but then it was so difficult. And I want to welcome my third guest, Ken Karstens, who is the great grandson of Harry Karstens. Many Alaskans have heard of Harry Karstens, quite a legendary figure in our history. And he's joining us from Colorado. Thanks for being with us, Ken.
In Dallas, unfortunately.
Oh, I'm sorry. Right, you're in Dallas, but you live in Colorado. Yeah. Okay. And you told me that earlier. Yeah. So tell me, is Harry Karstens somebody you heard about a lot in family history from your great grandfather? And were you aware of what a remarkable person he was through family history?
No, because it was normal. You know, it was just another family member. You know, I have Texas Rangers, I have all kinds of weird family. And, it wasn't impressive until I went up to UAF and really understood where he was, what he was doing, and really was able to, you can't understand it until you're in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you're in Kansas, walking from point A to point B is nothing. It's flat. It's easy. There's nothing in the way. You know, walking from Eagle to Fort Gibbon, where nobody's really gone before, that's kind of unusual. It's kind of special.
Yeah, really. So you're planning to climb this mountain. Have you climbed big mountains before?
Oh, no. No, I live in Denver, right outside of Rocky Mountain, and I've been playing around in the 12,000-foot area, and that's fun. I can't wait to see what 20,000 is like.
Yeah. So are you training, getting ready for this climb?
Whenever I'm not in Texas, yes, I am.
Uh-huh.
much as I can. I drive up to Estes Park and right at the door of Rocky Mountain National Park, and I just start walking.
So do you feel any trepidation about taking on something like this? I mean, this is such a big challenge, such a big mountain.
Not really. I understand the risks. I know what they are, and I know what I can do. You know, I know it's dangerous, but it doesn't really worry me.
So, what do you personally hope to get out of this experience? I mean, you're repeating some family history, and you're being part of a big project. What do you hope to accomplish, or what do you hope to get out of it?
I'm honestly happy to see what he saw. I mean, Harry went to some amazing places. He saw what he saw. He did what he did. Just to stand in those shoes, it'll be enough. In 2010, I watched the sourdough anniversary go by, and you know, outside of a little painted moose in Talkeetna and a newspaper article, nobody remembered. It seemed to go by, and it was forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
And my son was born that year. I named him Charles McGonigal Karstens. Mm-hmm. And it's a horrible name to put on a child. It'll never fit in any form. But, you know, it meant a lot to me. You know, Charlie was Harry's partner from, you know, running those first males in the Kantishna. McGonigal almost died at Isabella Lake, running the first males out of there, out of Eagle up to Fort Gibbon. The next run, Harry almost died, and McGonigal had to save him. You know, it was a lot of family history.
These great adventures, for listeners who don't know, the sourdoughs were the other party that attempted the mountain, went straight from Fairbanks, and then, unfortunately for them, climbed the wrong peak. They climbed the North Peak and made it to the top and put up a pole so people could see they were there, but they didn't get into the history books quite in the same way because the North Peak is a little bit shorter.
And at the end of it, Tom Lloyd came down and said all four of them made it. took a little bit of the cachet out of that. You mm-hmm. had Cook in 06 lie about his expedition.
Mm-hmm.
You had Tom Lloyd embellish a little bit. You know, Belmore Brown would have been believed if he had come down. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Harry brought the Archbishop, I'm sorry, excuse me,
Archdeacon
of Yukon, with him as proof, I guess. You know, who's, you know, everybody knew Hudson Stuck wasn't going to come down and lie about it.
And Hudson Stuck was a tough guy in his own right. And I've got another guest who we only have for 15 minutes, who's another descendant, and I want to bring him on the air. Dana Wright is the grandnephew of Walter Harper, and he's joining us by phone. Dana, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us a little bit. I mean, Walter Harper is an interesting person. Tell us a little bit about your ancestor.
At the time, he was, I believe he was 21 when he did the climb, so he's still a very, very young guy to be doing such a, you know, big undertaking, obviously. He also didn't last much longer after that. He was aboard the Princess Sophia when it sunk off the coast of Alaska at 26. So his life was somewhat short-lived, but it seems like he had a lot of amazing adventures in that short period of time.
Yeah, and I asked this same question of Ken Karstens. Did any of those stories come down to you through your family, or did you learn about this sort of later from other people?
It was a little bit from both ends. My family had always told me that, you know, your great granduncle was the first person to be on top of Mount McKinley, and that had never really registered to me when I was a young kid. I also did a book report on him in. Well, I guess I'm not a book report, but I did a report on him in sixth grade about some of his life. So I've always kind of known about him, but as far as who he was as a person, I haven't really had many stories passed down my way. Obviously, he wasn't alive for a very long time to really create more of a family legacy. He only had his own personal accomplishments, but he's always been held in very high regard in my family.
Yeah. And he was only 25 when he died. I've got actually a book, The Ascent of Denali by Hudson Stuck, and this particular printing of it by the Mountaineers Press has Walter Harper's short biography and his diary from the climb in the back of the book. And it does sound like an interesting person. I asked this question of Ken. Is there anything you want to prove, or anything you want to come out of this climb with? Is there any sort of message you want to tell the world about from this thing you're attempting?
You know, really what I want to get out of this climb is I want to celebrate the accomplishments, of my distant relatives and everybody. This was a very, very big deal. Back in 1913, obviously, this would be an incredibly difficult thing to accomplish and survive and make it back down, you know, everybody in good health. But I do want to obviously realize that being in this situation, there's a lot of eyes on me, and so I want to make sure that I'm a good role model, and I want to make sure that, you know, I send out a positive message about this. It's not just about ego, really. I got a lot of family pride on the line. I want to make everybody in my family proud. I really want to. I'm very much a mountain person, as is. Born and raised in Alaska, I go out hiking in the backcountry to go snowboarding all winter long. So this is almost a natural progression for me. Obviously, Denali is considerably larger than the mountains surrounding Anchorage. But the opportunity came at just the right time in my life. I feel like I'm in peak physical condition. And I had the opportunity to represent my family, and I jumped at it. I thought it was a great idea.
That's great. So the show is Talk of Alaska. We are talking with a group of climbers or would-be climbers who are planning to go back up to the top of Denali to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the first successful climb of Denali. Two of the descendants of that original climb are on the line with us, as well as Brian Ochenick in the studio, who's climbed the mountain many times and is an expert on some of the earlier attempts. And Ilya Sekely, who is making a film and organizing the commemorative centennial climb. If you want to get on the air with us, the phone number here is 550-8422 here in Anchorage. If you're calling from outside Anchorage, it's toll-free, 1-800-478-8255. My name is Charles Woolforth. I'm sitting in for Steve Heimel. And I wanted to turn back to you, Ilya. I've asked this question of the other climbers, and I haven't really asked you. You're making a film. You're organizing this climb. It's a tremendous amount of effort, obviously, and there's still a lot of challenges ahead. What are you hoping to accomplish? What is the message that you want to come out of this project?
I think the most important thing for me at this point is really supporting this entire endeavor. So it's bringing my expertise as an adventure filmmaker who has climbed the highest mountain in the world, Mount Everest, and who has led technological initiatives that have allowed us to share those experiences with kids. And so I'm the founder of a nonprofit organization called Finding Life. And what we do is we inspire and we empower young people, and we create real-time experiences, and we involve these young people in our expeditions. So my goal would be to contribute all of my expertise to make this film, to help this team get their message out, to share this untold story, which really, perhaps within Alaska, it's known what these men and what these families did 100 years ago. But outside of Alaska, and even, you know, within the borders, it is unknown. And so in addition to that, what I'm hoping to do is bring on my expertise to create this real-time experience. So what that means is that thousands of young people and the public can follow this in real time for free. So what that means is that as we're climbing, we're shooting, we're broadcasting this back, we're creating opportunities for young people to literally speak with our team via Skype technology so that they can participate in this, so that they can learn about this, so that they can be empowered by this, and realize that the accomplishment of Walter Harper being the first man in history to reach the summit is something that is attainable for them as well, and that these huge mountains, you know, that they're struggling to climb in their own lives, that they have the power and the ability within themselves to conquer those challenges. So that's what I hope to bring, and you know, most importantly at the end of the day is to ensure safety of each and every team member, and that's from each of the family members to even you know, the Bishop of Alaska, who happens to be on our team as well, Bishop Mark Lateem.
Wow, I didn't realize that. That's fabulous. And Bishop obviously is going in a little bit in the footsteps of Hudson Stuck, who was the archdeacon from 100 years ago. So what are the, you know, you mentioned the challenges, and obviously fundraising is one of them. What are the major challenges or barriers that you need to overcome to make this happen?
Well, at this point, I think that the largest obstacle that we're faced with is the fundraising. So at this point in time, we've received incredible support, you know, from the State of Education, who have endorsed the project, to the National Congress of American Indians, who have passed a resolution, to the Galena District School Board and the Yukon Flats School Board. So we've received incredible support in that respect. However, we haven't raised a whole lot of money to make this happen. So what we've done is we've partnered with an Alaskan charity, the Alaska Village Initiatives, and we're looking and seeking donations, looking for, you know, sponsors, major corporate sponsors, to help pay for some of the technological endeavors that we are attaching to this project. And those are to make this an inclusive experience for young Alaskans so that they can be inspired by this team's centennial climb.
Do you have a climb if you can't raise enough money, or do you gonna put it on your credit card, or what happens if you aren't able to raise the money?
Well, at this point in time, and I'll speak on behalf of the entire team. So we've all committed all of our own funds. So personally, you know, I've invested through my production company to make this happen with our partners in Alaska. So that there's a climb, it's going 100%. But we are seeking donations to help support the technological initiative, which makes this an inclusive experience for all.
Right.
And the way to learn more about that is on the website, which is Denali2013.org, and that will link you into our Alaska Village Initiative's charitable fundraising page.
Okay, fantastic. Denali2013.org. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. I want to turn back to Dana Wright, because we only have him for a few more minutes, and Dana is the descendant of... or the great, or the grand nephew of Walter Harper. And I guess Harper was the first person actually to set foot on the summit. Are you planning to do the same, or have you guys talked about who actually gets to have that honor when you recreate the climb, Dana?
In my eyes, this one definitely isn't about who gets to go first. That's definitely something that we will discuss on the, you know, summit day. I would love to be the first one out of the group, but really, it's not so much about completely recreating this 100% accurately. It's more, in my eyes, about just celebrating the fact that they're all up there. I'd be perfectly happy being the last one up there, so long as all of us make it up there in one piece, and we all make it down in one piece, and we can all get back to our families and loved ones. But if the opportunity does arise, I'm young, I'm in great health at the moment, so I would hope that history would repeat itself, and I can be chipper and full of energy on summit day to do that. But honestly, I'm not too worried about being first.
So tell me the story, if you know Dana or maybe one of our other guests. How was it? How did it come about that Harper was chosen to be the first? Dana, do you know?
From what I understand, I just recently reread The Ascent of Denali, which you referenced to earlier, and I believe there are some cooking issues, which were partially Walter's fault, trying to make up the last bit of food that they had, and it seemed to get everybody's stomachs up in knots the night before and the following day, and for whatever reason, Walter was less affected by it. If affected at all compared to everyone else. And so he made it up fine. So who knows, maybe he sabotaged everything just to make it happen. I would hope not.
Well,
that's my understanding of it.
And perhaps Ken can offer some insight into sort of the unwritten rules of who leads on certain days dependent on how they feel. Ken, do you want to jump in on that?
The way we like to remember summit day was Harper was in the best shape. Yeah, he cooked the night before, but he was in the best shape that day, regardless of how he got there.
I got you.
Yeah, it's just that's a great story.
Well, you're just gonna have to watch Dana on the when you're making dinner the night before. You know, want to keep him away from the pot, right?
and it's probably also worth mentioning that, Dana just brought up Ascent of Denali, written by Dan Hopkins' great-great-uncle Hudson Stuck. There's also a new book which has just come out that Ken can tell you about, which offers even more perspective on the final days and the entire 1913 ascent itself.
And what's that book?
It's The 70-Mile Kid, Lost Legacy of Harry Carstens and the First Ascent of Mount McKinley by Tom Walker, a local author up at the park. Tom's been minding my family for information for coming on, 10, 15 years now. And he's the only one we've actually let in to look at Harry's papers. He's been dedicated for a very, very long time to understanding the stories and the rumors and the legends he was hearing around the park in his youth. And, he found a great source in my dad.
Yeah, and Tom is also a great writer and a great photographer, and a lot of people know. We're going to have to take a break, and we're going to say goodbye to Dana Wright, the grandnephew of Walter Harper. Thanks for being with us, Dana.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
And we've got a couple of callers who have been waiting very patiently. We're going to get to some of those calls after the break have more discussion about Denali and the 100th centennial, the centennial celebration of the original summit. So stick with us. We'll be back in just a moment when Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Regardless of where you live, you've got a better shot at earning the Alaska Performance Scholarship by enrolling in the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program. ANSEP challenges students with classes that are necessary to earn the scholarship. ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
It's Talk of Alaska. I'm Charles Woolforth, sitting in for Steve Heimel. And our topic today is the centennial of the first successful climb of Denali. And we have on the phone guests who are planning to recreate that climb, including a descendant of one of the original climbers. And in the studio with me, Brian Ochnick, a mountaineering guide and researcher on some of the previous history of climbs of Denali. On the line with me is Ken Karstens, great-grandson of Harry Karstens, and Ilya Sekely, who is working on a film and is organizing the centennial climb. And now I'd like to go, and let me give you the phone number if you want to get on with our guests. The phone number here in Anchorage is 550-8422. Outside of Anchorage, 1-800-478-8255. And now I would like to welcome Jeff Babcock, who's calling and I guess listening to us online from Arizona. And Jeff, you've climbed the mountain a number of times. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Charles.
You've written a book, and you tell us about your interest in this topic.
Well, I first climbed the mountain in 1967 with my my older brother, and we were involved in a terrible tragedy that happened that same summer. It was called the Wilcox Expedition tragedy, and of course I was 20 at the time, and it was a real life changing coming of age story for me. We did the same route. We went in from Wonder Lake and up the Mulgrew Glacier and Karstens Ridge in the same way that the Centennial group is going to be going. It was such a dramatic thing for me. You know, it's something I've wanted to write about all my life. And 10 years after that particular event, I lived in Alaska. I'm down in Arizona at this point, but I lived in Alaska for the better part of my adult life. And 10 years after, in 1977, I became totally enthralled with the early pioneer climbs, you know, which you've been talking about. Brian has done a tremendous amount of research on Delmore Brown's expedition, and I became very enthralled with Brown's 1912 expedition also. And I put together my own team, and I returned to the mountain. My book is called Should I Not Return? And believe it or not, I ended up following not specifically the same route that that Delmore Brown followed. He went up a creek called Ohio Creek, which was kind of by mistake, and then he crossed over into what's known as the West Fork Glacier Approach. And so when we did that in 77, my team got off the railroad at a little railroad depot called Colorado, and then we followed up the West Fork Glacier through what's been since called Anderson Pass, named after Pete Anderson, one of the sourdoughs. So it was kind of a monumental thing for me to do. It was a 68-day expedition, and we went right up, you know, like I say, through the Alaska Range, pretty much following, you know, the same way that Delmore Brown's route entailed. His group went down the snout of the Mulgrew Glacier, and then they crossed over into the tundra, and then they came back up through McGonigal Pass, which is the approach, you know, that I'm sure Brian can tell you about that. I took my group up through right up the Mulgrew rather than going down onto into the tundra. And that's what I've kind of done in my book is combined both of my expeditions on Denali. And basically you're getting all the pioneer stuff with Frederick Cook and the sourdoughs and Delmore Brown and certainly Archdeacon Hudson Stuck and Harry Karstens and all the rest of them. So the book has all this information in it, and it's thoroughly. There's lots of photographs, and I was fortunate enough to get the permission from Brad Washburn's daughter Barbara, or Betsy rather, and a lot of his wonderful photographs are also included in the book. And like I said, I kind of fell in love with the whole history of the mountain, mm-hmm. and that's part of what I wanted to write about.
Well, let me turn to Brian Ochnick. There are all these different routes that we're talking about that were done in the past, and Are those routes more difficult than the most popular route now is called the West Buttress, right?
And you
fly onto the Kehlton Glacier and then climb from there. Is that easier in some way than these other routes, or what are the differences?
Technically, the Carson's Ridge Route that was pioneered by the Sourdoughs in 1910, repeated by Brown in 1912 on his attempt, and then successfully climbed to the south summit by Stuck and Carson's party in 1913, is the same as the West Buttress. It's about the same type of climbing, but the approach is much longer. What makes the West Buttress so popular today is fly-in access. The Muldrow Glacier is within the wilderness part of Denali National Park, and aircraft landings aren't allowed. The southeast fork of the Kehlton Glacier is outside the old national park boundaries, the wilderness area. It's now within Denali National Park and Preserve, and glacier landings are allowed. So that shorter approach is what has made the West Buttress so popular. Bradford Washburn pioneered that in 1951, and it became ever more popular after that because of airplane access.
So it's a shorter total climb that way, and less just hauling stuff through the woods.
Much shorter. You're starting at 7,200 feet. You're many, many miles closer to the mountain. But what has to be remembered, in 1913, Denali, and particularly Carson's Ridge, was much different than it was before in 1910 and 1912 and today. The earthquake that the 1912 expedition had experienced back at their base camp on July 6th, turns out it totally shattered Carson's Ridge, and Stuck's and Carson's expedition found a dramatically changed ridge. What had been a very smooth snow and ice ridge that had some big exposure off both sides, but no hard climbing, was a broken, serrated ridge of ice blocks and pinnacles and huge crevasses. And it was Harper and Carson's who did all the lead climbing. And so they went out day after day after day, chopping steps and putting in the route. And it was technically much harder then than either Carson's Ridge or the West Buttress is today.
Interesting. I want to turn to Ilya or Ken, who are actually going on the climb this summer. Are you planning to recreate the same route, or what route are you planning to use? Ilya, or who wants to take that one?
Ken, do you want to take part of that, and I'll take the other part?
Well, I think we're going to do our best. Obviously, the mountain has changed. The route that was taken in 13 is unsafe. It goes right through an avalanche zone or two, and there aren't a whole lot of options on that side. We're going to go where AMS tells us to go, and do our best to stick with the high points. The details in between are, not really talked about anyway. So there's no way to really know for sure exactly where the footsteps actually are.
So AMS, is that the guide?
Sorry. AMS is the Alaska Mountaineering School, Colby Coombs.
And they're going to be your guides.
That is correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Ilya, anything to add to that?
Yeah, absolutely. We've actually been working with the National Park Services, who have recommended that we work with the Alaska Mountaineering School. And Colby Coombs and his team have been incredibly supportive, very patient with some of our difficult fundraising issues that we had faced. And, yeah, they've put in a couple of excellent guides that will not only ensure that we make it safely, to the top and back down and all the way back to Talkeetna, but, it's important to remember that the big challenge that we are faced with also is that we are filming this all as it happens. And to make it even more complicated, we're filming it and we're editing literally on the side of the mountain in a tent, and we're sharing this experience with youth across Alaska. So when you're going up, the Muldrow route, which really the way it works is, if you're a cameraman, you need to have two guides follow you, and you're tied together on ropes because the Muldrow is littered with crevasses. So it's extremely challenging, it's extremely dangerous, and that's where having, a guiding company like AMS, leading every step of the way, just helps ensure 100% safety up and down the entire route.
Mm-hmm. I guess there's never 100% safety, but there's as much safety as you can manage when you're climbing such a difficult peak. I want to go now to Bob, who's calling from Soldotna. Thanks for being patient, Bob.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I grew up in the interior, and I've only seen Mount McKinley gleaming in the sunlight off across the flats from the Tanawha Valley. My older brother Doug climbed Mount McKinley, or I call it McKinley, Denali twice back in the 70s. I don't know who he climbed with, but he said it was a pretty good experience. You talked about technology. You know, I was just sitting here listening to you. The difference in technology from those early pioneers that climbed mountains, and the equipment and the weight that they had to carry, I think is probably quite a tremendous difference from what climbers have today with lightweight clothing and gear. And you mentioned the, flying into Denali onto the one west Buttress Glacier, and the early pioneers like Don Sheldon of air taxis. I've never even been to Talkeetna, gentlemen, but I'd like to go someday, maybe get a little closer to that mountain, you know.
You should do it. Everybody should, every Alaskan should at least take one of those air taxi flights out of Talkeetna, where you fly around the mountain, because there is nothing in this world that will blow your mind like seeing that scenery. But I want to turn your question over to our experts here about the differences in equipment. In the Hudson Stuck's account of the climb, I guess they got to 8,000 feet. They had a fire. Their tents were destroyed. Didn't turn back. They just took some tarps and made new tents out of this needle and thread. Is it a different whole? And Brian, maybe you take that one first, and we'll see if the others want to add to it. But what the differences of equipment are unbelievable, right?
Yeah, of course. They were dependent on canvas for wind gear, fur for warmth, wool. The footwear was dramatically different. I mean, they were wearing typical trail mukluks with five pairs of socks inside, which can keep your feet warm but don't give you much ankle support for wearing crampons and climbing on steep snow and ice slopes. Their technical gear consisted of very long ice axes, which were fantastic for point of balance and for chopping steps. But their rope techniques were pretty crude. I mean, they were tying in with a hemp rope and with little knowledge of any type of crevasse rescue techniques. It was definitely climbing by the seat of your pants. They were very hardcore men.
No helicopter to come and get you if things go wrong.
No, there were no phone calls.
You just didn't come back.
No spot receiver, you know. I mean, you were on your own. And that's why they improvised and did what they needed to do. If something broke, if something got destroyed, they did what they had to do to put it back together and keep moving forward. In that same fire, they lost quite a bit of food, but they went, you know, without it and just kept forging forward.
That's one of the things that makes it such an amazing accomplishment to be first. It's more than what it is today. Now we have knowledge, we have technology. It was really extraordinary. We're going to take another quick break here. We'll be back talking more about the centennial of the first successful climb of Denali and the recreation of it that is being attempted. And I'll be giving out those phone numbers. We have a couple of calls to go to. Stick with us on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
It's Talk of Alaska Statewide. I'm Charles Wolforth sitting in for Steve Heimel. We're talking today about the centennial of the first successful climb of Denali, Mount McKinley. Hudson Stuck, Walter Harper, Harry Carstens, and Robert Tatum, and were the climbers who made it to the top. And three of those climbers' descendants will be climbing the mountain this summer. And we were talking to some of the folks on that, and also Brian Ochenick is in the studio, who's a mountain historian and a mountain guide. On the phone with us, Ken Carstens, great-grandson of Harry Carstens, and Ilya Sekely, who is with who's with Finding Life, and a filmmaker who will be organizing and filming the climb. If we have just a little bit of time left for the show, but if you have questions, the number here is 550-8422 in Anchorage, outside Anchorage, 1-800-478-8255. Or email talk@alaskapublic.org. And we're just going to go through calls and emails for a little while here. Emailer from Talkeetna asks, are any of the descendants bringing anything special with them to commemorate their relatives, historic artifact from their relatives, or a flag, and asks when the climb is taking place and how long? Ilya?
Well, maybe I'll actually pass that over to Ken, and as he responds, because I believe I know what he'll share, perhaps also to mention what Bishop Mark Latim will be bringing along with him.
Yeah, Ken Carstens, go ahead.
My dad will not let the family artifacts out of his possession until he is long, long dead. we have the original climbing axe, the last one from the climb. And he is driving it up because he doesn't trust the airline to confiscate it. He's driving it up for the display at museum at UAF for this summer. And then he'll be driving it home again a couple weeks later. We're talking about it. The Tatums have the original flag. We just learned about that, less than a week ago. And there's a rumor that it might be coming with us. We all have our fingers crossed. It might end up in the museum. It might come with us. Our fingers are all very, very crossed.
That's great.
But Ilya, the bishop.
It sounds like Bishop Mark Latim will be bringing Hudson Stuck's communion kit with him to the top of Denali this June.
Wow! So you might actually have a service up there, huh? Is that
an awesome idea? Yeah, it sounds. Mark, we feel incredibly privileged to have Bishop Mark Latim on board with us. He was a last-minute addition to the team. He's not a family descendant, but he certainly is connected spiritually by way of the Episcopal Church. And Mark is out in Alaska right now, dragging a sled, taking mountaineering courses, and of course, he hosted us at St. Matthew's Parish last Tuesday when we announced this in Alaska in Fairbanks. So we're extremely excited to have him on board, and Mark is just such an outstanding human being. You know, he stands almost 6'5", so he's really going to be a pillar on the team, and we all look forward to climbing the mountain with him this summer.
And that's in the great tradition of Hudson Stuck, who is a fascinating person, far aside of his mountaineering. He wrote the book 10,000 Miles on a Dog Sled, and he traveled the length and breadth of Alaska, learning about native conditions as well as being a missionary, and then went around the country as a lecturer to tell people about the really terrible things that would be done to Alaska Natives in terms of their food being taken by canneries and people starving on the rivers because the salmon runs were being destroyed, and had a huge positive impact on the conditions of Natives in Alaska. And the Episcopal Church has obviously got a really long history in rural Alaska.
And it's, if you don't mind if I add something there, and, it's, I think what has really driven all of us and really, with my personal connection to, Hudson Stuck's great-great-nephew, Dan Hopkins, the whole idea for us was to really bring to light, the vision that Hudson Stuck had for, young Native Alaskans, and he really believed that, the highest point in North America, Mount McKinley, otherwise known as Denali, should first be summited by a team comprised of Native Alaskans, and he wanted to empower young Native Alaskans. So Walter Harper, John Fredson, and Esaias George, were those young leaders. They were proteges of his, and you can see what Walter Harper accomplished by being the first man up there. So, he stands to be an incredible role model to many young Alaskans and really youth across the world. And so not only are we hoping to bring all that to life, but in addition, you know, I think it's about recognizing the previous attempts as well. And, you know, through the film that we want to create, we want to recognize everybody's efforts and demonstrate what's possible, but also show those that pioneered, you know, the route pre-1913, who I think, and Ken, I think you can agree to this, you know, made a huge, huge contribution in the success of the 1913 ascent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And it is that an Alaska Native was the first, I think, is a great symbolic thing that Stuck probably understood. We talked a little bit about what the food was like the night mm-hmm. before, but that could have been part of it, too. Now I want to turn to Leanne, who's calling from Anchorage. Leanne?
Hi.
Did you have a question or comment?
Yeah, I just wanted to weigh in on why this centennial is really the important one. I'm a veteran Denali guide, actually, for the Alaska Mountaineering School, and consider myself an Alaska Range history lover. And I'm from Fairbanks, so what I'm about to say is pretty blasphemous, but I'm not convinced that the Sourdough actually made it to even the North Summit. I've personally been on the Harper Glacier several times. In fact, I almost met my maker there during a really intense storm in 2002. And it's really mean. The descendant of Carson's mentioned that the centennial of the Sourdoughs went kind of unnoticed, and I wonder if it's a subtle reaction to the fact that we all know that it may not necessarily be true, but we really like that story, so kind of let it be unspoken and generally accepted knowledge. And so I'm really glad that the centennial of the true first climb is receiving attention, and my best to all the team.
Okay, thanks, Leanne. That's a great topic of discussion. We could probably do a whole show on that, but for listeners who don't know, the Sourdoughs we call them that because they're just a bunch of old gold miners, or I guess, met in the bar and said, let's climb to the top of Denali. And if you go to Denali National Park, you will hear a lot about them. They supposedly carried a spruce pole up to the top of the mountain and then found out they were on the wrong peak. What do you think of that? You know, did they make it, Brian Okunik? I mean, will we ever know? Or what's your opinion?
They certainly said they did. And when Brown was on the mountain in 1912, he looked for the pole with binoculars from high on the northeast ridge of the South Summit and never could find the pole. But then the Carson Stuck expedition saw the pole as they moved across the lower basin of the Harper Glacier to their first camp on the Harper from Parker Pass. And they Walter was the first to see it, and then the rest of them could see it. So that's
pretty good confirmation.
Yeah. And I just want to mention happens to be that tonight I am giving a slide presentation about the early exploration and history of the mountain at the Wilda Marston Theater at the Lusac Library at 6:30. So if anybody's interested in the Sourdough trip or Brown's trips and the early pioneers around the area, join us at Anchorage tonight.
Fantastic. So that's this evening at the Lusac Library in Midtown in the Wilda Marston Theater. Free admission?
That's free admission. It's put on by the National Park Service Conservation Association.
Fantastic. And now Joseph has been waiting patiently to get on the air with us. Joseph?
Hello. Thanks for having me. And I just wanted to say I'm excited about hearing about this expedition. It sounds like a great thing that you're doing. Several years ago, I was about 2003, really wanting to climb the mountain. So I started to get in shape to do that and suddenly got very ill with heart failure and subsequently was being listed for a heart transplant. And they ask you if you have any goals if you get the transplant. And they said, yes, I want to be the first heart transplant recipient to summit Denali, and I wanted to know if that's just frivolous or if you think it might be possible at all, or what are the thoughts on that?
Yeah, but Brian?
I would say give it all you've got. You know, you just never know. I had a client one time who was a heart transplant patient. He decided, he joined us for a mountaineering course, and he decided after that not to continue on with his aspirations to do Denali, but each person is his own individual, and you might as well dream big.
Yeah.
Can I jump in there for a quick
Please
second?
Please do.
I just wanted to let you know that my climbing mentor, Gabriel Philippi, who has really taught me everything I know, who, you know, got me to the summit of Mount Everest the first time and who has guided me another 8,000-meter climbs, he led an expedition up to the summit of Mont Blanc with a cardiologist with a heart transplant recipient. So they made it, and it was a huge, huge endeavor, and it was successful, and it was, you know, carefully crafted and under the guidance of a cardiologist, but he did make it. So, I mean, let's leave it at anything is possible.
So you can dream, Joseph. Well, thanks for calling. I want to go to another call. John is calling from Homer. John?
Good morning. You hear me?
Yeah, go right ahead.
I kind of think it's appropriate to mention some of the women who have climbed. Bradford Washburn's wife was the first, but then a good friend of mine, Honora Jones, was the second. And they went in by dog team, and they put up their own food, dried moose meat and seal oil. She was like a 19-year-old student at the University of Alaska. But just for the record, hats off to all the Alaskan women climbers.
There you go. It hasn't all been men. That's right. And we're really out of time, but we haven't really talked at all about the Tatum family. And I guess, Ilya, you had trouble finding them. Is anybody from that family going to be able to join in just in a few seconds?
Well, in a very short, brief comment, as of, I really think it's the last couple weeks and then 24 hours, it seems that we've located both members of the Tatum family and the George family, as George's descendants. So we will certainly be in touch. We've been looking hard unsuccessfully, and so we do apologize on behalf of all of us for not reaching out to them because we just couldn't find them, but we certainly will be in touch, and they will definitely be included in the celebration.
Oh, great. Well, it's a great endeavor, and I think we'll all be following you and looking forward to hearing success and a safe climb and a good centennial. And I want to thank each of my guests. Earlier, we heard from Dana Wright, who's grandnephew of Walter Harper. Ken Karstens has been with us on the phone. He's the great-grandson of Harry Karstens. Ilya Sekely is with Finding Life. He's a filmmaker and organizer of the Centennial Climb. And in the studio, Brian Okunik. I'm Charles Wolforth. Thanks for joining us for Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD, or paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you are an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an individual artist award. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.